Hebrews chapter 11 says, "Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. For by it the people of old received their commendation. By faith we understand that the universe was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things that are visible. By faith, Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain, through which he was commended as righteous, God commending him by accepting his gifts. And through his faith, though he died, he still speaks. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he should not see death, and he was not found, because God had taken him. Now before he was taken, he was commended as having pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please him. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. By faith, Noah, being warned by God concerning events as yet unseen, in reverent fear, constructed an ark for the saving of his household. By this he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith, he went to live in the land of the promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. By faith, Sarah herself received power to conceive, even when she was past the age, since she considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, from one man and him as good as dead, were born descendants as many as the stars of heaven, and as many as the innumerable grains of sand by the seashore. These all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had an opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was in the act of offering up his only son, of whom it was said, "Through Isaac shall your offspring be named." He considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. By faith, Isaac invoked future blessings on Jacob and Esau. By faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. By faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw that the child was beautiful, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasure of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured, as seeing him who is invisible. By faith he kept the Passover and sprinkled the blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn might not touch them. By faith the people crossed the Red Sea on dry land, but the Egyptians, when they attempted to do the same, were drowned. By faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. By faith Rahab the prostitute did not perish with those who were disobedient, because she had given a friendly welcome to the spies. And what more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who, through faith, conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouth of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection. Some were tortured, refusing to accept release so that they might rise again to a better life. Others suffered mocking and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were killed with the sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy, wandering about in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. And all these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better for us, that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. Let's pray. Oh God, this morning we ask for the faith that you can only provide. You may open our eyes to see truth. In Jesus' name, amen.
All right. If you will, turn to Daniel chapter 3. And as I began to study this chapter, I realized how little I knew, not only about Daniel, but about Babylon. And I will warn you young people right now, do not rely on Wikipedia. Because officially, Wikipedia, and I'm not going to get in a rant by this, Wikipedia will tell you that the biblical narration of the Tower of Babel is a myth and a parable. So look for a better source when you're doing any kind of research than Wikipedia, and for that matter, Mr. Google, to a degree, I would think. But anyway, we're in the third chapter of Daniel, and I'm going to read the first 7 verses, and then we'll discuss that. Starting in verse 1 of chapter 3 of Daniel, and I'm reading from the New King James Version. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the province to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So the aforementioned satraps, administrators, governors, counselors, treasurers, judges, and magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces of Babylon gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald cried, and this must have been in an area that a very large crowd of people could hear. The herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship will be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." So, at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, harp, and lyre, in symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. My first question when I read chapter 3 was, what happened? Do you remember last week in chapter 2? The declaration that Nebuchadnezzar made when Daniel was able to interpret, not only interpret, but tell the king what his dream was all about. How did he respond? Anybody want to refresh our memory?
He fell down to worship him. He said that Daniel's God is the God of gods, Lord of kings.
He was astonished. He had to say something. He was the king. I decided to check into the history of Babylon and the Babylonian people, and specifically the king. And it was all new to me. But I understand, and I think accurately, at the time that this happened in the third chapter, Babylon was the largest city in the world. It was the first city in the world to reach a population of 200,000 people. Its size was about 4 square miles. It was the site of one of the 7 wonders, of the ancient world, the Hanging Gardens. And earlier, it was the site of what we think was the Tower of Babel. Of course, they were polytheists. They had innumerable gods to be accountable to, or they thought. The patron deity, the patron god of the city of Babylon, was Marduk, M-A-R-D-U-K. They called him at the time the god with 50 names. His temple, at this time, the Euphrates River ran right through the middle of the city. And on the east coast of the Euphrates River at that point was a temple. And it was the temple of Marduk. Now, he also went by several names. He was called Bel. He was called Merodach, Baladan, and Evil Murdoch. Merodach. Close by, but in the city, was a tower. And I just now forgot the name of the tower. Not the actual name, but what is called, what that type of tower is. It was a Babylonian or Mesopotamian version of a pyramid, a ziggurat. Ziggurat?
Ziggurat.
Ziggurat. It was a ziggurat. It was a seven-stage building with a temple at the very top of it. At one time in New York City, and I did not write this down, the tallest, at one time, early on in New York City, I guess, there was one building known as the tallest building in the world. This ziggurat was 300 feet tall. And that just floored me. But the question is, what happened between chapter 2, and we open chapter 3 and says, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold. Now, what does gold have to do with chapter 2? Somebody under 15 tell me. No. I don't buy it. Okay. There was a figure in his dream, and it was comprised of all kinds of different
metals.
Yeah. But the top was gold. And what did Daniel, after Daniel got the interpretation from God, what did Daniel say?
Gold meant Babylon.
Okay. Not just the land.
It was the king himself, Nebuchadnezzar.
But Nebuchadnezzar. Well, Nebuchadnezzar had rebuilt that ziggurat, and we think that was the basis for the story in Genesis of the Tower of Babel. We think it was, and there's all kinds of different opinions on some of these things on ancient history, and I can't tell you in some cases exactly what I know or what we know to be the answer, because the so-called experts disagree, and to a great deal. So what happened in between the time when Daniel interpreted the dream? Oh, by the way, I've seen estimates that between chapter 2 and chapter 3, there was as much as just a couple years, anywhere from 6 to 13 to 40 years of a time span. There's no way to know for sure how much time passed between chapter 2 at the interpretation of the dream and chapter 3, when Nebuchadnezzar made the image of gold. What would you suppose? What would you suppose would be an answer to why he did that? Remember in chapter 2, what did Daniel tell him? This statue represents the kingdoms. Babylon was the greatest. The head was of gold, but as you went down on the statue, they were less and less important. And so Daniel, in effect, was telling Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon may be great today, but it's not going to be in the future. There are going to be lesser kingdoms that rule the world. And some so-called experts said at the time that Nebuchadnezzar ruled from, get this, now this may be an exaggeration, but they said he ruled from India to Ethiopia. And Ethiopia is just south of Egypt. So the greatest ruler, the greatest warrior that day knew was Nebuchadnezzar. He rebuilt that ziggurat. I hope I'm saying that right. I didn't write it down. It was 300 feet tall. I'm thinking that Nebuchadnezzar said, even though he was astonished and he made the declaration about not his God, Daniel's God, it wasn't his God. Even though he was astonished by the prophecy in chapter 2, I think his ego got the best of him. He had accomplished all these things, fabulous buildings, just one military victory after another. And it would not surprise me that his ego said, I'm not going to listen. I'm not going to even give a thought to the fact that this land is going to, or this empire is going to be ending, and it's going to be replaced with one that's not as great as this one. So he makes himself an image of gold. Now, we can't say for sure. All the experts, they don't agree. And some of them come out and say, well, we can't know. But this image, a statue, it says an image of gold, probably up to this point in the world, nobody had built anything made exclusively out of gold of that size. So it was probably plated with gold, but it was 60 cubits. The height was 60 cubits. That's, who knows? Isaiah.
90 feet tall.
90 feet tall, and its width 6 cubits, which is 9. So the total height was 90 feet, but that had to include a pedestal to build it on. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon, and it was close enough to the city that anyone in the city could have heard the music and the commotion. So the administrators, all the officials that answered to Nebuchadnezzar, were they were commanded to attend this dedication of the image. Now, there's no set answer to the question, what did the image represent? Did it represent their god, Marduk? Or did it represent Nebuchadnezzar himself? No one has a sure answer, as far as I can tell, from what I've read. But like anything else in a pagan culture, they would if they would do it a dedication to an image, you would be expected to worship that image. And that's exactly the situation here. Whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately that day into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. And Nebuchadnezzar had that ready. Now, as I said, we don't know the period of time that passed between chapter 2 and chapter 3. It doesn't tell us, so undoubtedly the author, the writer, did not think it was that important. Because Daniel did serve for a period of about 60 years, not only to the Babylonian Empire, but to the Persian Empire that came in and took it over. So it says that, let me get my place here. Let me read just briefly what Matthew Henry said about this in his commentary on chapter 3. He said the following, and I quote him, pride, and bigotry cause men to require their subjects to follow their religion, whether it's right or whether it's wrong, and when worldly interest allures, draws people, and punishment overawes, in other words, the idea you will worship, not so bad, but if you don't, a fiery furnace awaits you. And I understand that they built the fiery furnace was like a tunnel closed off at the end, but there was a way to see what was going on. So it tells us that they were cast down into this fiery furnace, and yet later the king was able to see what was going on. So what he says, when worldly interest allures and punishment overawes, few people refuse. He said, this is easy to the careless, the sensual, and the infidel, which is just an unbeliever in general, who are the greatest number, and most will go their ways. There's also, he says, there's nothing so bad which the careless world will not be drawn to by a concert of music, or driven to by a fiery furnace. By such methods, false worship has been set up and maintained. And I think we, to a degree, can see the attraction, even in the Christian world, the attraction to music in many of the large congregations. And this is exactly what was used here. All the instruments that are mentioned were not common to each group of people. Some of this stuff, and I wouldn't try to, and they say it's not 100% sure what all of them were, because they came from different groups of people, the Mesopotamians, the Greeks, there's two or three. That's why he addressed himself to peoples, nations, and languages, because there was a little bit of everything, including the Jews. Anybody comment? Any question so far? William?
Well, just thinking, you asked what happened to him, and I just was reminded of Romans 1, just being played out, as it always is, that men suppress the truth and unrighteousness, and they worship the creation rather than the Creator. And that's just what unbelievers do, and that's what he did. And he not only had the creation, natural, he was also given the supernatural from Daniel. He recognized it, he acknowledged it, suppressed that truth, and keep on trucking. That's what natural man does.
Right. But isn't it, I don't know if you had the same reaction to this as I did. It was close to what you would think this was a change of heart. But we know from what follows it wasn't. He was astonished. He something happened that he thought couldn't happen, because he was willing, remember, he was willing to kill every one of his wise men because he didn't even believe in them. But he undoubtedly believes so much in himself that he now constructs or has constructed this image of gold. Ben?
Well, you hit on it earlier. You said he was a polytheist to start with. So the just added God, our, you know, the true God, to his list of gods. And at the moment, he put him at the top because that was like what was going on in the, at the moment. But, you know, that's just, that's a knee-jerk reaction to what happened to him at the moment. He's still a polytheist, so, I mean, it's very likely he went out and, you know, won a battle or something. And now, in that moment, Murdoch, or whatever his name was, is now he's the best again, which would be consistent as for a polytheist to do that. It looks inconsistent to us, and it would be inconsistent to us if what he meant by your God is the greatest God, if he meant and the only God, then it would be inconsistent. But he didn't say that. He just said your God is the greatest.
So there's still a whole pantheon of people, of gods to worship and to adore. And Daniel's might be one of the best, but it didn't change.
He later, I mean, he goes, I believe from the history of the event with Daniel and the image, is actually before the fall of Jerusalem. And so, actually, him going later and destroying Jerusalem could have lowered Daniel's God in his estimate, in that I just defeated Daniel's God and destroyed his temple. Maybe that's where all the gold came from for the statue, for all we know. That's speculation. But, you know, as a polytheist, that's the way they thought. You know, one God would get elevated above another one depending on what was going on in the newspaper, right? Sound a little bit like our eschatology situation. What's going on in the newspaper was driving their belief.
Any time there was a victory, it was attributed publicly to their God.
They had many.
It was attributed to them, and what was I going to say? He acknowledged that this was a God that had given Daniel the prophecy that he did. He did not acknowledge he was the one true God. He was still a polytheist, even though his statement, it surprised me. I thought, wow. And then I said, well, let me read on. And then this first verse says, what happened? What in the interim? It's not so important how long it was, but something happened between chapter 2 and chapter 3 showing us that Nebuchadnezzar, if we thought so, we were wrong. He did not have a change of heart. He just had astonishment. He blurted something out, you might say, but then he thought about it and decided he wasn't going to roll over and accept the idea that there was a lesser kingdom coming and he wasn't part of it. So he did have an image of gold. And it says in verse 7, I don't know if I read this. So at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, harp, and lyre in symphony with all kinds of music, all the people there, nations, every nation represented, and languages fell down and worshiped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Let's read now in chapter verse 8, read through 12. Verse 8 says, therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery in symphony with all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews, talk about anti-Semite, There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. And of course, they were faithful subjects of the king, and they were worried about him not getting the proper respect. They have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods. Wonder who the Chaldeans serve. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. The next question. They have slandered, they have accused the Hebrews of violating Nebuchadnezzar's proclamation. Now, I'm not sure of the span of time between this first acknowledgement by everybody to this message from the Chaldeans. Ben, did you have something?
Yeah, I don't believe they slandered him, because that means that they spoke this truth about him. I think they actually spoke what they said.
Okay.
They actually didn't do it, so they're just reporting what happened.
Okay. Well, they accused him.
You think they did it in malice?
Yeah. Yeah. Because, see, the and I didn't mention this, the Chaldeans were astrologers. It kind of reminds me of the New Testament. Who were the sharpest critics of Jesus and the early Christians? The Jews, but not only the Jews, not so much the street level Jew, the religious leaders, the rich. And some of them were rich because of religion. That's why they had to be driven out of the temple, because they were making a profit at God's expense. And it was an abomination. So they accused the Jews. Oh, the Chaldeans were astrologers. In researching this, I found that they were originally inhabitants of southern, what we would call today southern Judah, in that particular area. They were well educated. And their astrology was really their god, and sometimes they're mentioned as astrologers, but their ethnic background, maybe, is that they were Chaldeans. So the two words names were interchangeable. Jen, Ben. Southern Babylon, not Judah. Not Judah. Okay, so they were part of a ruling class until Nebuchadnezzar came along. And he ruled everything there. And they were used to being listened to. They were used to having an important place in society. And here, these Jews, these children, you know, these children were being raised to a high degree, and in the mind of the king, in his thinking, I mean, we read last week, or we heard last week, that when they were put to the test, or even from the beginning, you know, the three Hebrew They were called children to begin with. Were taken and were put in a study program, and it was supposed to last for 3 years. And after that, or by the end, or even before the end of that, the king recognized that they were 10 times better than the so-called wise men that he had. Ben, did you have anything? I thought.
No, I was asking that question about the South Babylon.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Okay.
I will make a statement, though.
Go ahead.
So that's interesting about the change in the political structure when Nebuchadnezzar came to the throne, perhaps his dad, whatever, however that played out. But all of these different folks, Nebuchadnezzar, as well as the Chaldeans and so forth, they all saw and understood the dynamic of Daniel not only telling the dream, my goodness, but then giving an interpretation of it, but telling the dream that had been not revealed. Right? This is what only those that do not dwell with men can do. And we think, we are tempted to think so frequently that if something were done in just the right dynamic way, so if some sort of magnificent display were put forward, surely people would believe God. You ask the question, what's up with Nebuchadnezzar? Well, he doesn't say that this is his God. He just acknowledges, yeah, that was pretty incredible. However,
he just added them to the group.
But what I mean is, however, is the pride of man. Mm-hmm. I'm still going to make the decisions around here. Right. I will not subject myself. Think of the rich man that Jesus tells of with Lazarus. And the rich man says, I have 7 brothers. Send Lazarus back to warn him not to come here. And the Abraham says, they have Moses and the prophets. They will not believe Moses and the prophets. They will not believe though one were to rise from the dead. And that we see this with the Chaldeans here, as well as Nebuchadnezzar, that this magnificent display of God's wisdom and knowledge over everything, and they shrug it off.
Okay. So the charge has been made. We don't know if there was a extended period of time between this first introduction of the concert and the worship of the gold image or golden image. They say they do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. And Nebuchadnezzar's response in verse 13, in rage and fury, he gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, I don't want to get ahead, but if you've read the chapter, you know that they did not deny that they had not worshiped. I wonder if the Chaldeans were worshiping or watching the Jews. I don't know. And I don't know the period of time that passed. But let's think about this. The command of the proclamation of the king was, you will fall to your knees and you will worship the golden image. So let's think about this. Depending on the interpretation of the word worship, which is not spelled out for them that we know of, or for us. Young people, what would be the harm if the three Hebrews at the appropriate time, when the concert reached its climax, if they fell down and pretended to worship? Would God blame them for wanting to save their young lives? What do you think?
He would blame the children for worshiping.
He, say it again, I can't hear you.
He would blame the three Hebrew children.
Why?
It says you're not supposed to bow down nor worship them.
Okay, let's turn to Exodus chapter 20. See what it says. Specifically, for a situation just like this. Exodus chapter 20, and we want to read, I'm going to read from the New King James, verses 4 through 6. Oops. That's the wrong, okay. Exodus 20, starting in verse 4. This is part of the Ten Commandments. This is what verse 4 says. You shall not make for yourself an idol of any kind, or an image of anything in the heavens above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on their children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. Verse 6, but showing loving devotion to 1,000 generations, imagine that, 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. They could not, in good conscience, because of their love of God, and did you raise your hand?
Yeah. Go ahead, finish.
They could not, in good conscience, pretend, because even that would displease a holy and a righteous God. What were you going to say, William?
I was going to say I'm not entirely sure that that could be applied. Maybe it is, but it appears to be an intent here. And because I don't know if it would all be encompassed under make for yourselves an image. I would think it's maybe that the command is, the point of the command is, you shall not worship in your heart, because worship is a heart matter, is an intent matter. And, you know, just like, you know, putting your hands together and doing all kinds of things that look like you worship, doesn't mean you're worshiping God, the true God, even though it looks like it. And the same could be true here, that it is a, whatever the word is, posture. Not sure. I mean, I'm willing to say that maybe you're right, but I'm just saying, not sure that God would blame them, but maybe so. I don't know.
Anybody else?
The idea of worshiping. Because that's what they were commanded to do, to worship.
Yeah. They could defy that command. And how's he going to know the difference? Because worship is a thing of the heart.
And I think that's more what the point is that others should not have grounds to question what you're worshiping. That would indicate how sincere your heart is. If you're really glorifying God, you know what? If I am truly loving my wife, I sure hope I'm not putting my arm around another woman. Well, she knows what I mean in my heart. Yeah. do it enough so that, that there's no way to, no mistake in here.
I understand. That's right. I might say, you know, it could be a different story though if you're in some sort of incredibly weird situation. Criminals had a gun to your head, asked you to put your arm around some other woman. I'm sure your wife would want you to do that so that you could come home to her. And it wouldn't mean that you don't love her.
See, that's not where it's going to stop. It never stops there.
Well,
no.
You might be right. I don't know, I'm just saying.
No.
That's just where my thinking was.
Yeah, but it never stops there.
Appeasement never works.
Torture, if they can get you to do one thing, they got you. If you will go just one thing, they got you. If it's true, right? Like Vietnam, they would talk about being tortured, and they come up with all sorts of scenarios, and they have these spy networks. A prisoner that was being tortured would put together a story just to have something to say, and it was like, you know, Babe Ruth, Mickey Mouse, and so forth, on the New York Yankees or whatever, and that would be, and that way they could remember what they were always saying, okay? But it was a lie, and the torturers knew that. They knew. But it was some way for them to make a statement and not say the wrong thing. Because if the torturer knew that they ever got them to say anything right, that was the crack. They were going down.
I would say, from what I remember, most of the time, they were given something to read that was edited by their...
Oh, yeah, like with the video camera?
Torturers, yeah, right. That was common. That happened commonly with prisoners of war.
During this interlude, I would like to also point out, I don't think it would be accurate to consider Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego as children or even young men at this point. They are likely full-grown men, so that's out of the equation. The idea that there's any sort of like youthfulness or anything like that going on.
It's possible. We don't know for sure. In the Jewish tradition, boys are boys until they're 13 years old.
Yeah, but I just don't see how that they're going to be placed in these positions of authority and actually be functional if they had to be at least like in their 20s, I would say.
Well, it's close. That's much closer. They were referred to as children in the first chapter. Since then,
that's when they were taken out of Jerusalem.
And when they were under 13. And then they had 3 years of Babylonian indoctrination, education, language.
Yeah,
they were at least 15 years old. But I can't say, I mean, nobody knows for sure. We're not given a way to calculate that. Right, they were called young men.
They were called young men back in verse 2 or 1, but not here.
Are you talking about chapter 3? Right, young men, or men. Okay. All right. We're in verse 13. Then Nebuchadnezzar, I mean, he accepted what they said. I don't know how they knew, unless they were paying real close attention, they had an agenda and some access to the young men. In rage and fury, he gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these men, 13, before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, "It is true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." He says, "It is true that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image." Is it true? I'm sorry. Is it true You do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up. Now, if you are ready at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. Were they being arrogant? Were they being disrespectful? Or were they just stating a fact? We have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, in other words, if we do not worship, we do not bow down to the image, if that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. How could they do that apart from a solid, secure faith in the God that they served? They couldn't have. At the same time, they said, if it happens, it will happen. But our God is able, and we're willing to make that sacrifice if it's his will. Again, in verse 19, then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I wouldn't be surprised if the king thought he was giving them a chance to back down. But because of the faith, and we read about that in Hebrew, that every one of the people mentioned in the 11th chapter of Hebrew was what they were, became what they became because of a solid and most of the time unbending faith in God. Or I would have to say not even sometimes, but all the time. He was full of fury. He was wrong, and it made him even madder. He thought he was giving them a chance at life, and he would be commended for his great mercy. He spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. Now, the 7 is a important word. Who knows what it stood for?
Perfect number, like number of perfection.
Okay, so it signified the furnace is to get as hot as is possible. I read a thing that said in a crematorium, and that's where people have their body cremated, the temperature can get from anywhere from 1400 to 1800 degrees. And one of the so-called experts said that this one did get up to 1800 degrees. But at that point, what's the difference? But anyway, he told them, give it all the fire you can, give it all the fuel that you can. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. These men were bound, that is, the three Jews. These men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and were cast in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Imagine. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent, do it now, as he had said, and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men. And they're described as mighty men of valor who were in his army. The flame of the fire killed those men who took Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down, bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, verse 24. He rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said to the king, true, O king. Look, he answered, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. First of all, he saw them loose. They were tied. They were bound together. He saw them loose. Four instead of three, loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they're not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. Commentators disagree a whole lot on this verse. What was the king really referring to when he said the fourth? The form of the fourth is like the Son of God. I mean, how could he know? How would he know who the Son of God, as he called it, was in this particular case? Now, Nebuchadnezzar may have listened to Daniel. He might have had chance to hear from the three Hebrew men about the Son of God. But to him, in his polytheistic way of thinking, recognized that this was some kind of a divine being. And it seems among Christian commentators, some say that this one with the form like the Son of God was an angel that had loosed their bonds in the fire. And some say it was who we call the Son of God, Jesus Christ, before his incarnation. I guess I could say it that way. I can't tell you. I can't tell you what was in Nebuchadnezzar's head. Again, he was astonished, but this astonishment didn't bring him any closer to the real God than the last one. I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. What kind of miracles does God have to perform for us to come to Christ, for anyone to come to Christ. I mean,
you have to perform the miracle of a renewed heart.
It's not when we look at Jesus' ministry, no one in his day could do what Jesus did. He proved that he was who he said he was. But the miracle that led to, if you have faith today in Jesus, if you have truly been born again, the miracle above, beyond miracles, is that God planted that faith in you, and it was a done deal before the foundation of the world. Any comments? Any question? William?
I was going to say it reminds me of the stony ground, where some people will rejoice and say, wow, this is
astonishing.
Yeah, this is a great, this is a wonderful God, and really believe, but not have a living hope. Mm-hmm. It is the belief of the devil.
I've heard, I'm thinking either Paul Washer or can't think of his name, black preacher.
Vodibachum.
Has a video out in which he says that hell is going to be filled with people who thought they were Christians because they prayed a prayer at some point in their life. They prayed a prayer, and that made them a Christian. And apart from the miracle that God performs in your heart, in your soul, you can pray like the Muslims pray, 3 times a day. Pray 10 times a day. God is the giver of life. He is the author of salvation. And at this point, Nebuchadnezzar is astonished, but he's still old Nebuchadnezzar. He hadn't changed a bit. Verse 26, and Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God. This is an unsaved man. This is an infidel. Come out and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the midst of the fire, there was a crowd there for the show. And the satraps, administrators, governors, and king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose body the fire had no power. Just imagine. It killed the men that put them in the furnace. But the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them. How could you say that was anything but a miracle? Nebuchadnezzar spoke again, but it's We know from later chapters, it's the same old Nebuchadnezzar. Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel. There's what he thought. Sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him. And they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies, that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. It frustrated his word, yielded, offered their own bodies. Didn't argue. That if it's so and you do it, we're okay with that, but we're not going to bow. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there is no other God who can deliver like this. Verse 30, the king ended up promoting Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. There is no other God who can deliver like this. Then why worship false gods? The miracle of regeneration had not occurred. But God's not through with Nebuchadnezzar yet, because the later chapters tell us or show us that in spite of all his proclamations, in spite of all his astonishment, he's still dead in trespasses and sin, because God has not yet performed a miracle. Then he promoted them in the province of Babylon. So, what can we learn from the third chapter? A couple thoughts. It's possible, young people, that our lives might take a terrible turn like Daniel's exile did. The fact of the matter is, in faith, we know that God knows these things and works them through to achieve his purposes. We must learn, as the three Hebrew men, formerly called children, we must learn flexibility to live in the culture we're placed in right now, without being unfaithful to the kingdom of God to which we pledge our allegiance. Somebody called it the fine art of compromise without capitulation. Capitulation is surrendering or giving up. We must learn to live in this culture, and granted, it's worse than anybody my age has ever seen. Never did we think we'd be where we are. We pledge allegiance to God, so we have to learn to compromise without surrendering. Well, they...
What's compromise?
Good question.
We have to give ground without giving it all. I think that is... I'm rather opposed to that statement. We shouldn't tell people absolutely the truth. We just shouldn't lie to them.
Well, we try to fit in. We try to live in the culture we've been placed in.
No, sir. We fit in with God. We do not fit in with the world. We are supposed to be strangers, pilgrims in this world. Mm-hmm. If the world love you, consider carefully the life that you are living, for you have compromised. And they speak all manner of good about you. Be concerned. If you're not telling the truth, then
They're not hearing the truth from an individual who they say, you know, I really like that guy, I like hanging around him. He's one of my best buds. Should they respect you? Yeah. I mean, I just say should, but respect would be proper.
Live peaceably.
The compromise would be on our traditions. And we, as Christians, sometimes can be very stubborn and not want to compromise with others. But we should be willing to compromise every one of those. But the Lord's word, no.
I don't think that's compromise.
Right. I'm just saying, but to a lot of leaders, they feel that bad. It's like a...
Could be.
They have the consciousness of sin when it's not really a sin there. And they, I'm taking my hat off indoors because I'm a Christian or whatever it is.
But what it turns into is we say, well, you know, homosexuality, I believe that it's wrong, but I'm not sure that it should be punished.
Shouldn't what?
Shouldn't be punished. I'm not sure that it should be punished. Or, you know, yeah, adultery, that's not what we said we were going to do when we got married, but come on, that's everybody.